step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A haunting account of the 16 years when a young Jamie Gehring and her family lived closer than anyone to Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. As a child in Lincoln, Montana, Jamie Gehring and her family shared their land, their home, and their dinner table with a hermit with a penchant for murder. But they had no idea that the odd recluse living in the adjacent cabin was anything more than a disheveled man who brought young Jamie painted rocks as gifts. Ted was simply Ted. An erratic behavior, surprise visits, and chilling events while she was riding horses or helping her dad at his sawmill were dismissed because he was just the odd hermit. In fact, he was much more. Ted eluded the FBI for 17 years while mailing explosives to strangers, earning the infamous title of Unabomber. In Gehring's investigative quest 25 years later to reclaim a piece of her childhood and to answer the questions why, how, she recalls what were once innocent memories and odd circumstances that become less puzzling in hindsight. The innocence of her youth robbed, Gehring needed to reconcile her lived experience with the evil that hid in plain sight. In this book, through years of research probing Ted's personal history, his writings, his secret-coded crime journals, her own correspondence with him in his Supermax prison cell, plus interviews with others close to Kaczynski, Gehring unearths the complexity, mystery, and tragedy of her childhood with the madman in the woods. And she discovers a shocking revelation. She and her family were in Kaczynski's crosshairs. A work of intricately braided research, journalism, and personal memories, this book is a chilling response to the question, do you really know your neighbor? The book that we're featuring this evening is Madman in the Woods, Life Next Door to the Unabomber, with my special guest, journalist and author, Jamie Gehring. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us with this incredible tale, Madman in the Woods. Let's get right to this. And as you discuss in the beginning of this book, you explain the relationship, the proximity, life next door to the Unabomber, but its start and in its connection to nature and the comfort and adventures you had in nature and in your childhood, and then this relationship with Ted next door. So tell us a little bit about how close the proximity you were to Ted's cabin and just the relationship you had with your family and this little area that you describe in the book.
Yeah. So in 1971, my grandfather, who owned close to 9,000 acres of ranch land, sold a small plot of land to Ted and David Kaczynski, specifically 1.4 acre. And Ted Kaczynski otherwise known as the Unabomber, ended up building his cabin there. Our family's ranch land surrounded his property. In the late 70s, early 80s, my father and mother built their log cabin just under a quarter mile away from Kaczynski's plot of land. And so in rural Montana, this was actually very close, honestly, as neighbors go, specifically in that area. It was very isolated, of course, where Ted Kaczynski was living, and very secluded. It was about 4 miles away from town. And when I say town, it is the town of Lincoln, Montana, approximately 1,000 residents. There is not even a stoplight that changes color from red to green. It is right. A blinking yellow, tiny little town. Wow. And honestly, my childhood was looking back, and that was a really great part of writing this. It was so beautiful to grow up that way in nature and, you know, building forts and being in complete isolation. And that's definitely a question that I ask myself through the book, is how could these beautiful woods inspire me the way they have and nurture me while isolating and, you know, darkening our neighbor, the Unabomber?
You talk about the first step in your, you call, journey of exploration started at the local library in Denver, Colorado. Tell us about your beginning.
Yeah, so since Ted Kaczynski's arrest in 1996, I've always wanted to tell this story. I've always wanted to write this book. And knowing that my father had a part in the investigation, of course, inspired me that much further. And when I started researching, after I decided I'm finally going to do this, it took years to read, you know, about the accounts that I wasn't present for. The FBI's investigation, for instance, and even Ted's own brother, David Kaczynski's account. And so it really began in the library in Denver, Colorado, with me checking out every book that I could find about Ted and just trying to really place myself in those narratives that, again, I just wasn't present for.
Now, you go back in this book and you start with the first impressions of this odd hermit next door, and you were 4 years old. So take us back to this scenario, where you lived and how you lived and your family lived, and your first meeting with Ted and your interaction with him.
Yeah, so my first memory of Ted was when I was around 4 years old, and we were living in our little log cabin that my parents had built. I was outside playing, as I did all of the time, by myself, and it was just another typical day out in rural Montana, and all of a sudden, I saw Ted coming towards the home. And at that time, he was still a bit more like, his appearance was a bit more like the Berkeley professor than the Ted Kaczynski you see when he was arrested.
Right.
Yes, he did definitely have, his hair was disheveled and he looked like he lived off the land as a hermit would. But he didn't have that more terrifying appearance as he did when I was much older.
Right.
So when I saw him coming towards me, I was excited, just as I always was when Ted would come by the home. And I remember just very, very vividly the feelings that I had when I was a kid, and specifically in this encounter. He had brought me painted rocks as a gift. And I was so excited and so appreciative of these beautiful creations. I mean, I loved rocks. And I thought it was so thoughtful that he had painted them for me and took the time to bring me a present. So that first memory was very fond. And that was difficult for me to reconcile as an adult, how I could have such a soft memory of an encounter with a killer.
Let's get back to your research and the materials that you had to read. You say it took years because there was so much material. Everybody knows about the manifesto, 35,000 words, but you started with other materials. Tell us about some of those materials and what you began to learn about Ted Kaczynski.
Yes. So there was a memoir that was written by David Kaczynski, and I started with that. It was more of a personal account of what it was like to grow up with Ted. And that's, you know, initially what I was looking for is that personal part of the narrative. And then in addition, I had read a book, I believe it's Robert Gray Smith's book about the Unabomber. And it was a very journalistic approach. It was his crimes and his background. And that was, you know, very interesting. And then there was another book written by, co-authored by FBI agent Max Knoll about the hunt for the Unabomber and the investigation. And then after I read those books, I read Ted's own autobiography, which is essentially a PDF that he has written of his own accounts and his life. So that was also, you know, very, very interesting. And then I started to read Ted's journals. And so when I say journals, they're notebooks that were found in the cabin after Ted's arrest. And it's truly his innermost thoughts. It's also details of his crimes, but it's day to day what his life looked like, what he thought about, what he was reading, what he was hunting, what he was eating. And it really gave me a very intimate look into what my neighbor was doing and thinking all of those years while we lived so close by.
You mentioned David, his brother's personal account. What did you learn about Ted's background and, for example, his school background and his motivation for moving to this isolated place?
So what I learned about Ted's background was I had heard that the accounts of Ted being separated as a baby from his family in the hospital. And, you know, I was able to glean a little more intel, I suppose, on that particular event in his life. It took place while he was only 9 months old and a very vulnerable age as far as development and separation anxiety. So that was an interesting look into, I suppose, the making of this man. And then through school, I learned that Ted was on an accelerated schedule. He was advanced a grade.
Right.
He graduated early. Mm-hmm. He graduated at 16 and went off to Harvard. So, and he had always felt very isolated, I suppose, from his peers and not able to truly relate. And of course, that is understandable given a bit of his background. You know, obviously there was probably some mental illness that was present there as well. And so, you know, through the years, really those experiences, although individually seem small, really shaped who he was and who he is. And of course, we all know then he went to Harvard at 16. And, you know, there was some questionable experiments that were done there. And, you know, that, of course, also seemingly fueled him. And he does write, even in 1971, when he purchased the property from my family, he writes about his motivation for moving to this small parcel of land. He writes about his motivation for revenge and how he was fueled by anger. So it was very obvious, even in those early years, what Ted Kaczynski's intentions were.
You mentioned it was very interesting to learn about these humiliation experiments, knowing how powerful, just reading the initial title, humiliation experiments, and knowing how much humiliation is a major factor in a lot of the most serious killers' backgrounds. Tell us about these experiments.
Yeah, so there's not a lot available on these particular experiments, but what I did find is that Ted Kaczynski was a part of, as you said, these humiliation experiments, where basically the student was asked to write down their personal ideals, their beliefs, and sort of in an essay form, they were submitted, and then they were brought back in to debate these and defend their most personal beliefs. And really what happened is they were paired against a successful interrogator. And really, for Ted Kaczynski specifically, I believe so much of his own personal worth was tied to his intelligence. And having someone break down his thoughts and beliefs was particularly destructive to him. It was a stressful situation. You know, they were measuring heart rate. They were looking at a solid mirror so they couldn't see past. They knew there were people watching them, and they were measuring the stress response when people were placed in these types of positions. And again, for Ted specifically, he was at a vulnerable age. He was, you know, 16, 17. He was a minor when this was happening.
Right.
And he already felt isolated and different because of his background. This was just one more thing that pushed him into isolation, I suppose.
You mentioned, but we haven't talked about, but I think it's important, and you think it's important as well, is this rash and this hospitalization at 9 months, I believe. So tell us what ensued, and what do you think it seems was the result?
Yeah, so when Ted Kaczynski was 9 months old, he developed a rash all over his body. A severe case of hives is what it seemed to be. And his mother did what any mother would do and rushed him to the hospital. The staff took him. They were scared that his airways might close. And so they were treating him. And, you know, back in those days, they didn't allow the parents to stay with the children or the babies at this particular hospital. And so he was separated from his caregiver, his constant, and he was put on basically like splints so that he wouldn't scratch this rash all over his body. And in my research, I found that his mother always harkened back to this specific event. Even in his adulthood, she was writing letters to him, trying to connect still while he was in that little cabin in Montana, and referencing this event and telling him that this changed him. And she thinks that's where the hatred that he held for his parents really stemmed from, because she had to leave him and he was alone and he changed after that, she said. When he went into the hospital, he was, you know, meeting milestones and this happy, friendly, bouncy baby boy. And after the experience, she says basically he was a dead lump emotionally and had more of an institutional look. And it took a long time to get even just a part of that baby Ted back.
Now, you talk about Ted and the effect of this early hospitalization had on him, according to his mother. Now, he had a family that was typical family, a loving family, it seemed. And so they seemed to understand Ted and his peculiarities. And they were supportive of Ted moving to this isolated place and this cabin. So tell us what your family, their response was to this new neighbor and some of the things that your understanding father and mother did with this new neighbor and how they considered him.
Yeah, in rural Montana, it is not alarming to have a neighbor that lives off-grid or chooses to live more of an isolated life. And so when Ted had moved to Montana and started developing a relationship with my father and my mother, they took him for what he seemingly was. And anytime they would have him over for dinner or play cards with him and, you know, spend time as neighbors do. And they would start talking, you know, asking personal questions, you know, like you would, where you're from, things about your family. Ted would always deflect and he would respond with answers that were very much on the surface. And my parents, from those experiences with him, just thought he must have a pained past. Or, you know, possibly another theory was that he was a disenfranchised vet. I mean, there was something that he didn't want to talk about. And so they really respected that this neighbor of theirs needed space. And he was a little bit eccentric. But they, you know, he seemed like he was peaceful and shy and reserved and even kind in those early years. So, you know, they had him over for dinner. They would even, my parents did, my mom and father did get divorced and my father remarried. And in those later years, even with my stepmother and my father, they would bring Ted firewood or they would offer to have him work at the mill. And, you know, in the early years, Ted helped build certain parts of our home and helped my father and they traded labor. So through the years, there were so many things that, you know, my parents tried to do for this seemingly man of the mountains.
One thing you didn't mention is that your father went further and offered the tools and the shops that he operated and used and offered those to Ted to use any tools and to use these structures whenever he needed it. Didn't he?
Yeah. So my dad was very generous and would always help his neighbors out. But specifically, it was another neighbor, Chris Waits, who really opened up his workshop to Ted and his welding equipment, any sort of tools that he needed, even, you know, his land, which he owned quite a bit of property in a place called McClellan Gulch, which is just about a mile away from where we were, 5 miles from town specifically. And that really allowed Ted the resources that he needed for bomb building and even for additional isolation, because he was building bombs and testing bombs in our backyard, but also in Chris's backyard. And he even had a cabin that he had built on Chris's land in McClellan Gulch in case he needed to run and hide. And so these very trusting people in this really tight-knit community in Montana were really fooled by this man.
You say that you interviewed Chris Waits in 2018, and he has a book, Unabomber, The Secret Life of Ted Kaczynski. What did he say to you in that interview?
So Chris actually was able to really shed some light on the early years. And, you know, the 1970s, especially the later 70s, Chris and Ted were friends. And, you know, as much as I suppose Kaczynski would befriend someone, they would take rides in to town together. Chris would pick him up and they would talk. They would talk about the books they were reading or the hikes that Ted had recently gone on. And they had formed a relationship, a friendship together. And of course, for obvious reasons, as the years went on, that friendship definitely did dissolve. But that was a really interesting perspective for me to hear, is that Ted Kaczynski that was, again, a little bit closer to the Berkeley professor than the Unabomber that you conjure up when you think of Ted.
Right.
And so it was just a look into a different perspective, I suppose, a friend, the early Ted, while he was still in his early years of domestic terror, but he resembled the man that many actually had known still. So in addition to that, he did he did share with me the years that followed, which were much more terrifying. He shared his dogs being stabbed and poisoned and killed through the years, his wife meeting Ted in the woods without actually knowing that it was Ted, but later realizing it had to be him because of what she felt. You know, there were even times that he shared with me that Ted would be outside of their home watching them late at night. And right. So there were, as the years ticked on, some really horrifying events that Chris was able to share with me.
One part of your book that is even more telling and revealing is in 1978. Ted returns to Chicago to work with his brother at a factory, foam cutting engineers. What happens here? He leaves his cabin, 1978. He goes to Chicago. What happens in terms of romance or potential romance and work at this factory? How does it all work out?
So Ted did return to Illinois in 78. And, you know, the motivation behind that is still unclear, whether he needed money for funding or if he needed to be around his family. We're not quite clear on, but he did return and he started working with his brother and at the factory, and he found a love interest by the name of Ellen Carmichael. And it had been quite some time since Ted had spent time with a woman. They had gone on a few dates together. They went apple picking and he took her out to a French restaurant for dinner. And then she broke it off and it really destroyed Ted. And again, it wasn't a serious relationship. It was only a few dates, but it really affected him. And even his brother remembers Ted just completely shutting down after Ellen called it quits. And Ted was so filled with anger that he posted limericks about Ellen, who also worked at the factory, all around the factory, about a limerick about her body. And it was, I mean, David Kaczynski was appalled and of course made Ted take down the limericks. But then the next day, another one was up and David had to fire his brother. And of course that just made the fire inside of Ted grow. And he actually, it was found that Ted had planned to disfigure Ellen. He had set up a meeting to talk to her, and he had a knife hidden in a paper bag with plans to attack her. And they did, they were able to talk. And his, as he explains, I think he specifically says something like his anger fizzled out and he didn't feel the need anymore to hurt her, thankfully.
He talked to his mother about this. It was such a traumatic event to him. And the woman had said when he confronted her to ask what the problem was, is that she said he lacked social confidence and that she was just interested. He said, well, why'd you go out with me? But just interested in you because I'd never been with a person like you. So he talked to his mother about this event and this lack of social confidence and social skills and never felt the love of a woman. He talked to his mother.
Yeah. And in his autobiography later, when he's talking about this event, he mentions that Ellen had said that you lack confidence socially. And he admits, like, this may be true, but still a mean thing to say. And so, you know, again, looking back on Ted's history and, you know, his childhood and just kind of the isolation that he experienced growing up and his feeling of just being awkward around his peers and not really connecting and not being able, you know, being younger, he wasn't really a candidate for the girls to be dating in his grades. And so he always felt just a little off, a little different. And I think that this was very the obvious with the relationship with Ellen, and it most likely, you know, affected him as an adult as well, and being uncomfortable in that sort of situation and maybe feeling a little more vulnerable when he was, broken up with.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. You say your parents split, and then you talk about the library, and you talk about Ted and this garden, this huge garden he had. So he's in his more still normal, more so normal phase, and you see him at the library. Tell us about some of these interactions you have with Ted at this time.
Yeah. So in the early 80s, even mid 80s, there were plenty of times where we had interactions with Ted. And although he was still a hermit and he was still very much isolated, he would come by the house, he would come into town, he would go to the library and read. And sometimes when my dad and I would stop by, he would be there and we would offer him a ride. And, you know, sometimes he would say sure. Sometimes he was on his bike and say no, thank you. And he would definitely come into town for supplies. He would come into the grocery store. And, you know, he was a fixture in our small community. People, although didn't have close relationships with him, they all knew him and would see him, especially walking in and out of town or on his bike. And he was just, to everybody, he was just Ted.
What was happening with Ted's development and enacting revenge via bomb making at this time?
So in Ted's own development, those early years of bomb making were, as the FBI describes, his bombs were very primitive. They were match heads and, you know, some gunpowder. And they weren't, I hate to say it this way, but these are Ted's words, they weren't as successful as he would have hoped. They were maiming people, but they weren't killing people. And that is what Ted dedicated himself to. He took years off of sending bombs to develop bombs that would be lethal. And reading his journals, if he were to only maim someone when he intended to kill someone, he would be disappointed and he would write about that. So as the years progressed, his bombs definitely became more, I suppose, effective to him and advanced. And again, that is what he committed his time and his life to.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Jamie, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. This summer, I'd like to learn about how to fix our cement stairs, how to do proper cement work and repairs, and save some money doing it. If you're always learning, it keeps you sharp, like ZipRecruiter. Their AL is always learning. So if you're hiring, their AL gets better and faster at finding the right candidates for all of your roles. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Then it proactively presents these candidates to you. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job, which encourages them to apply faster. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. based on G2 ratings. And now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So, Jamie, we were talking about the development of Ted and his, as you provide with excerpts from the journal, he took time off to be able to develop the lethality of these. He was disappointed that they weren't more effective in killing his targets. So let's talk about some of the things that he complained about, that he was obsessed about, such as jet noise and technology, and then some of the targets and the people that he targeted for murder.
So Ed would write in his journals about not being able to escape society or completely remove himself from the social machine. Even when he was hiking in the woods, he would run into people, or he would hear the noises of jets, or he would hear the noise of my father's sawmill that was very close to his property. There were sometimes people who had come into our own property to help my father log, or to later on to my father leased mineral rights for some time. And so Ted would complain about the outsiders and people in general and seeing them in the woods. And so it was clear that these types of interactions would, I don't know if they would fuel him more, but they definitely justified his violence. And the strange thing about this particular case is that Ted was complaining about industry, about technology, and his targets were very indiscriminate. Like he was attacking universities, and yes, he was directly attacking airlines. He tried to blow up Flight 444 in 1979. He was, throughout the years, though, still sending bombs and placing bombs at universities and trying to injure and kill people that, looking back on now, were really trying to do really incredible things for humanity. And it's strange to see the different types of targets that Ted had. And again, he was getting his information from directories that he would read and choosing targets in that fashion. I mean, he wasn't using the internet. There wasn't Google. He was perusing these different directories and finding people that he thought were really representing these industries that he wanted to destroy. And in reality, he injured and killed many innocent people that, again, were trying to better other people's lives and humanity as a whole.
You talk with Max Noel from the FBI, and you find out some disturbing things, because initially in this, you say that you were naive, and you try to find an understanding of how this person, this hermit, this innocent, seemingly odd person hermit that gave you the four painted rocks as a present, and you saw him and interacted with him many times, as did your family. Max Noel informed you, and all of the materials that you read, that your family was in the crosshairs. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very difficult part of writing this, because in 96, when Ted was arrested, there was almost a feeling of relief that lived, my family had lived by this man for 25 years. 16 years of my life were spent right next to a serial killer, the longest running domestic terrorist in United States history. And once I really started reading Ted's journals and sat down with FBI agent Max Knoll, I discovered that we were in much more danger than originally thought. I guess it was a naive assumption that Ted Kaczynski wouldn't be committing acts of domestic terror in his own backyard, but he did. He was, you know, from smaller things like sabotaging equipment or breaking into a home and destroying somebody's kitchen and bathroom and snowmobiles outside, to actually poisoning my dog and injuring Chris Waite's dogs, and then to really considering killing the people that he lived by. For instance, my stepmother discovered after Kaczynski's arrest that there was a day in which Ted had her and my little sister, who was only 2 at the time, in his crosshairs. He was looking at both of them through a rifle, considering killing them. And so those types of things were really difficult to discover and, of course, to write about.
You talk about the sabotage with your parents' sawmill and some of the other things that you read that were surprising. And you had a little motorbike as well. So you say that what was most alarming, or one of the things that was most alarming, was this neck-high fence wire booby trap that he had set up.
Yeah. So after Ted's arrest, my father had shared with me that there was neck-height wire found around our property. And of course, initially, I think it was probably my age. You know, I thought, oh my gosh, that is really horrible that he was trying to kill someone. And then, of course, later when reading his journal entries about admitting, you know, and again, when he was writing these journal entries, it was like he was talking to an audience, which you'll see in my book and the ones that I reference. But whoever he was telling in these journals and these notebooks, he was admitting to trying to decapitate, trying to kill someone with wire that he would string up on a blind corner neck high. And of course, as an adult, the realization that I was riding my little Honda 90 motorcycle around our property on these logging roads, I was lucky to be here and not have fallen into one of those traps.
You had to read, and you detail in the book, but you say there are other books as well that detail the crimes themselves, but you had to read the horrific details of what happened to, say, Scruton, Howard Scruton, I believe. The first victim, and all of the details of the explosion itself, and all the other attempts he did to maim people, in which he maimed people, but tried to kill them. So while you tried to balance and try to have an understanding of how this could possibly happen, you were reading information that just reinforced that he was nothing but a possibly immature, but definitely mentally ill psychopath.
Yeah, reading about the accounts, even just the statements like from the coroner when Scruton was murdered, and then reading the victim impact statements, and, you know, hearing things like in Susan Moser's account of the day that her husband was killed, and trying to comfort her children, who she would have to tell that their father was dead. He was murdered, and wanting to go back into the house to grab her daughter's baby blanket to comfort her, but it was soaked in blood. It was, I mean, especially as a mother, it was horrific to read those words and to write about those events and truly the devastation that he created and the ripple effect of that. Not only these wives left without a husband, but their children left without a father, and all the birthdays, all the Christmases, through the rest of their lives, they'll have that piece of them missing. And to reconcile that it was our neighbor, the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, that was inflicting this horrific violence and destruction on these families was really devastating.
You talk about Max Noel and the FBI, their decision to release this manifesto. And this must have been a hard decision, a difficult decision. But what was their idea by releasing this? And then, despite what people have heard about David coming forward, what it wasn't exactly David finding out. Who first found out and recognized the unique writing contained in this manifesto? But first, tell us about Max Noel and the plan to release this manifesto.
Yeah, as we were talking about earlier, part of this process for me with the interviews and the research that I did was really hearing about those parts of the narrative that I wasn't present for. And of course, the FBI trying to decide if they're going to publish the manifesto from this domestic terrorist was something I wasn't privy to until I was able to sit down with Max Noel, and he shared what it was like to be in the FBI investigating the Unabomber case at that time, and what they were really struggling with, which was giving a domestic terrorist a voice in the media.
Right.
And really what it came down to finally was they were hoping that somebody would recognize the specific idioms and the thoughts of this terrorist in the manifesto. So it was a really difficult decision, but the FBI weighed out the consequences compared to the reward, and they knew they had to catch this person who had been terrorizing this nation for 17 years. So once it was published, it was actually not David Kaczynski that recognized the particulars of the railing against technology. It was Linda Patrick, his wife. And she had to come to her husband, David, and tell him she thought that Ted was the Unabomber, which, as you can imagine, would be a very difficult position to be in.
Now, from that, they finally decided to call the FBI. And then what's interesting in this manifesto, too, is that Kaczynski pretends to be part of this Freedom Club and pretending that there was an actual number of members in this group. So from when they had released this manifesto, you write too, it's very interesting that there was immediately thousands of calls. In fact, you write interestingly, 59 brothers swore it was their brother. So
yeah, that is something that Max Noel shared with me, which is, it really is just an incredible amount of people, for one, suspects, and also specifically for brothers that were under suspicion that during this time.
Now, with the FBI, it's just not as easy to take David's word that this is definitely his brother and he's the Unabomber. It's hard to believe for David. It's hard to believe for the FBI that's been looking at this case for 17 years. So, but they still have to have a plan. They still have to get a warrant, and they still have to involve somebody that's close and is trusted, or is at least not suspected as a ne'er-do-well or someone that's threatening to Ted. So tell us about this entire process of your father and your family being involved in the takedown of Ted Kaczynski.
Yeah, so this was another part of writing this and learning some aspects of this story that I hadn't known that was really important to me, because my father was very private about his part in the case. And as I sat across from Max Knoll so many years after Ted's arrest, he was able to share with me not only my father's part in the investigation and the takedown, but also Max's innermost thoughts, especially when it came to first seeing Ted Kaczynski. So in the months prior to Kaczynski's arrest, of course, the FBI set up in Lincoln, Montana, and started kind of their investigative work as to who they were going to work with, how they were going to do it, and who they could trust. And FBI agent Max Knoll was introduced to my father by a mutual connection, Jerry Burns, who was a Forest Service officer that Max had reached out to. And during that first conversation specifically, they were both kind of feeling each other out, Max and my father, kind of both determining if they could trust each other, who they really were. And, you know, Max did tell him he was with the FBI, and they were researching our neighbor, Ted Kaczynski, for writing some threatening letters. And, you know, my dad's initial reaction was kind of like, oh, Ted, really? Like, that's really odd. But then as they continued their communication and Max knew that he could trust my dad, he did tell him that they suspected that Kaczynski was the Unabomber. And of course, my dad was shocked. I mean, the man that had been living in that little cabin next to our family for 25 years in a 10 by 12 shack, no running water, no electricity, off-grid, surviving on about $200 a year. He just could not reconcile that in his mind. And of course, then he started thinking about all of the kind of strange encounters through the years, and even like his sawmill being sabotaged and what Kaczynski stood for, the railing against technology and industry. It all kind of made sense. And my dad started coming around to the idea that yes, this man was the Unabomber. And so my dad actually offered to take Max up to the cabin and get a view of it, because my dad had frequented the area that our property surrounded Ted's. And so it wasn't unusual for my father to be up there. So they walked up there. And as I talk about in the book, the FBI Max Knoll ended up getting his first look at Ted Kaczynski as our dogs were barking and Ted exited the home for a moment to see what the ruckus was all about. That was FBI agent Max Knoll's first look at this man that the FBI had been hunting for 17 years. And here he was in this tiny shack in rural Montana, completely disheveled. And in no way did he resemble what Max had in his mind, what this man would look like. So that was just a really impactful story, I suppose, that Max shared with me about his first look at the Unabomber and, you know, my dad's part in that. And then, of course, as time progressed and the investigation did as well, there were other things that the FBI asked of my father. And one of those very large things being that they needed to get an idea of what the terrain, you know, looked like around Ted's cabin. And so my father was asked to videotape Ted's cabin and the surroundings. And of course, at that point, he knew that Ted was suspected as being a murderer. And he was, of course, terrified to do that, to go up with his handheld video camera. I mean, of course, now we have our iPhones, but this was the 90s, and right. those camcorders looked a lot different. They were much larger, mm-hmm. but he did it. He walked up there with his camcorder at his hip and videotaped the logging roads, the terrain all around Ted's home and his cabin.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Jamie, to stop for a second for these messages. Now, your father was instrumental in getting the photo taken and helping them identify where this cabin was. And while he was with them, they saw their first, like they saw Ted Kaczynski, this person that just wasn't some other image in their mind. But your father also offered something else and that was relative to the FBI. What else did your father offer and was a big part of?
My father was able to express to the FBI what would alarm Ted, because as they would find after Kaczynski's arrest, Ted was looking. He had a lookout tree. He knew that at some point someone could discover who he was. And so he was very aware of any outsiders. So my father really helped the FBI fit in, I suppose. I mean, they had chosen to rent a dent truck, and they were dressed up, you know, like they were miners or loggers. And really my dad helped them develop that cover and then suggest that, you know, a way to get Ted Kaczynski out of his cabin and able to. And I want to add that the FBI really wanted to ensure that it was a safe capture. And, right. and that was partly because, I mean, that's their job, but also it was David Kaczynski's concern as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they didn't want a big shootout. They didn't want a Waco situation. And so any way of being able to arrest Ted while he was outside of his cabin was what they were shooting for. But Ted wasn't leaving his cabin. And so they didn't have an opportunity to arrest him. And so my father suggested that they approach the cabin and let Ted know that they were from this mining company that had been leasing the mineral rights on our property, and that they just needed to confirm property lines. And of course, Ted was always very, very worried about his own personal private property, and they knew that this would definitely be a way that Ted would leave his cabin. And that is, in fact, what they did. And it did ensure a safe arrest in which Ted Kaczynski left unharmed and alive.
You write about seeing this on the news. Where were you and when you saw this? And this person that you saw when you were four, you said he looked different when you were 10 and the relationship was a little bit different. You mentioned in the book, what about his appearance?
So I was back in California with my mom when Ted was arrested. I had spent the year previous in Lincoln. And so I had seen Ted, but I initially heard it on the radio. And my dad took the confidentiality so seriously on this case that I didn't know what was going on. Wow. My own stepmother, his wife, didn't know what was happening until basically the day of the arrest. And so, and that was a request by the FBI for obvious reasons. So I was in complete shock when my radio was interrupted with news that Ted Kaczynski was suspected as being the Unabomber and had been apprehended in Lincoln, Montana. I mean, I think I was in shock. I couldn't quite process that information. And, you know, in just the days after, I watched the news constantly and then was finally able to talk to my dad about it and hear, you know, more of the background and what actually transpired. But it was just a very pivotal moment in my life to see Ted Kaczynski on the news in handcuffs. And, you know, he had always looked a bit disheveled. He had always been eccentric. But in that moment, his clothes seemed to be rotting off of him. His eyes were so wide. There was gray in his beard and his hair was completely disheveled. He looked like a madman. And that was very difficult to process.
You say in this book, you write that there was some correspondence with Ted Kaczynski in Florence, Colorado, in prison. In the end of this book, you try to come to terms with this. When you say you were naive in the beginning, you tried to look for some comprehension, some justification, some relation to this person other than this nature setting that enthralled your family and you, and still does, and as well as Ted Kaczynski. So tell us about that, coming to terms.
So I have always wanted to write a letter to Ted Kaczynski since his arrest. And I think it was probably part of my need for a closure, I suppose. And, you know, with writing this book, I finally decided I wanted to. And yes, I was still, in addition to that, I was still searching for some kernel of good. And yes, I had already discovered all of these horrific detailings of the murders. I had known about the killings and the maimings, but to see what then Ted was writing about them and how he was motivated and fueled by this and just the sheer violence and terror of it definitely allowed me to look at it through a different lens. But I was still hoping for that just little piece of good. And so, you know, I thought maybe he's had years to reevaluate. He's been sitting in prison all of these years. Maybe he's sorry. Maybe he has regrets. And it was my attempt to provide closure by writing to him and acknowledging the fact that he fooled us. And that was really shocking when he was arrested and finding out his true identity. And then, you know, also to find out, you know, if there was remorse or if there was any sort of intelligent commentary still there, or, you know, maybe his motivations had changed. And that was really what fueled me in writing to him.
What I hadn't mentioned about this book too is that there isn't an amazing photo section. Could you tell us some of the photos that are included in this book?
Yeah. So this book is memoir. It's true crime memoir. It's my story, my family's story, braided with Ted Kaczynski's. And so I really wanted to add another layer of that, allowing the reader to really understand and digest our lives in a visual way as well, as brief as that may be. And in the book, I have, you know, me as a very little kid in my innocence in the early 80s. And then alongside that, I have Ted Kaczynski as a little kid on his pony. And in this, you know, again, just seemingly normal childhood where he was loved and supported and happy. And then I also have a picture of younger Ted, but, you know, definitely, again, a little closer to the Berkeley professor than the Unabomber arrested in 1996, but still active in domestic terror alongside his cabin in Montana. And that was taken by his family when they came out to visit him in the early 80s. I also show his bike that he would ride to and from town. And then I have pictures of our family again. My dad on the mill alongside our dog, Wiley, who I discovered that Ted had poisoned. I have my dad and I, and then I have my dad with my little sister, Tessa, who I talk about in the book. And, you know, especially in that experience with Ted looking at them through the rifle.
Absolutely.
And then I have me as a cheerleader the year before Ted was arrested. And then Ted's arrest photos with Max Knoll and Tom McDaniel alongside him.
Right on. You also, there's so much more to this book because you detail all of the crimes. You detail the reactions from the people at the statements at trial, at Kaczynski's trial, the heartbreaking statements that you include, again, outlining the devastation that this man single-handedly inflicted on a nation for 17 years. And then, of course, the collateral damage to his own family, your family, and anybody that came in contact with him. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this incredible book, Madman in the Woods, Life Next Door to the Unabomber, Jamie Gehring. For those that might want to take a look at more information, is there a website or a Facebook page or other social media they might look at?
Yeah, my website is jamiegehring.com. And you can find me just about anywhere, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Jamie Gehring Author.
Thank you very much, Jamie Gehring, Madman in the Woods, Life Next Door to the Unabomber. Thank you very much. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.